Money, Riches, and Wealth is sponsored by the Financial Consulate.
Freedom!
This is Talk Radio 680 WCBM. It's time now for Money, Riches, and Wealth. Here's your host, Drew Tignanelli.
And this is Drew Tignanelli, your Money, Riches, and Wealth. And my co-host, Christopher John O'Shea. Christopher?
And it's great being with you this fine winter's evening.
This is your first show of the new year.
Of the new year. I just had to say Happy New Year to Noah.
There you go.
So here we are.
Yeah, it's great. Last week, Tom and I struggled to get here on time. I mean, literally, I was 6:09 when I got here, and Tom got here at like 6:11, and today we just cruised.
Yeah.
And it was like there was nobody. It's like everybody deserted the town, you know?
Yeah.
What happened?
Yeah, which has been kind of nice a little bit this year. There have been days where the roads are a lot less clear.
I don't know,
people just taking the year off.
Anyway, tonight we have a guest.
Yeah,
right. We're talking to who are we talking? I'm going to let you do that.
Sure.
You've got all the intro stuff.
Yeah,
there.
Yeah, it'd be great. Richard Vague is managing partner of Gabriel Investments. He spent a lot of his 30-year career in the banking industry. Knows the subject that he's talking of, not just from a research standpoint, of which he did into the book, The Next Economic Disaster, why it's coming and how to avoid it. But he just knows, you know, in his bones, he just knows about the lending business, America, the history of it, you know, just how it works. And so he's also chairman of the Governor's Woods Foundation. So very interesting.
And his background was that he was in credit cards and things, so, right?
Consumer lender. So he was CEO of one of the nation's largest lenders, and you know came up the line through that. So he'll be able to tell us more about it.
All right. Anyway, Richard, are you with us?
I am.
There you are. All right, sir. Well, we understand that you actually today your main thing is you run a company called Gabriel Investments out of Philadelphia, right?
That's correct.
And you know, that's more of a venture capital firm, if we read it correctly from your website and other things. Is that correct also?
Yeah. Yes, we do early stage venture investing.
Early stage, and mainly for the Philadelphia area too. I find that interesting. Am I reinterpreting that also?
That's true, even though we kind of look all through the Mid-Atlantic.
Okay, but the question, I guess, the reason I'm asking you those kind of things is why would you, if you're headed in this direction, you're no longer in the credit cards and so forth. Why would you write this book, The Next Economic Disaster: Why It's Coming and How to Avoid It?
Well, when I was in the banking industry, I saw what caused the 08 disaster, and it was the rapid run-up in private debt, primarily mortgage debt. And I wondered, since I've been around for a while at this point in time, whether that was what happened in Japan's 91 crisis and Asia's 97 crisis. So we started to pull the data together and again and again, we saw that every major financial crisis was caused by a very rapid run-up in private debt. And private debt is both corporate loans and business loans. So it just felt like a story that needed to be told.
So were you in the private, were you in the credit lending business in 2008 when that all came down?
I absolutely was.
Who were you with?
I was CEO of a bank called Barclay Card.
Oh yeah, right. I remember that. I don't even know if it's in existence right now, is it?
It is. It is.
Okay.
It's thriving.
Okay. So you were there and you were seeing that phenomena happening in credit cards and so forth at that time?
Yeah, well, it wasn't really happening in credit cards, but since we were in the credit card business, we looked our own management reporting caused us to look at all consumer lending, and we could see the rapid escalation in mortgage debt. You know, in 2001, mortgage debt was $5 trillion. By the time we got to 2005, just a little over 3 years later, it was $8 trillion. So, I mean, that's an unprecedented level of growth in a very short period of time.
What was it when it hit 2008?
Ten.
Ten?
$10 trillion.
So it doubled in 7 years, and you're saying that's
exactly
pretty
right.
Much unprecedented.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, because he was also saying during that time period from 07 to 97 that $14.4 trillion in new private loans. You know, a lot of us
that's
were
right.
railing about the public debt. And we saw the budget deficits every year. So it was less than $4 trillion during that time. But
right.
Over $14 trillion.
And that's one of your points that you're making in this book, Richard, is everybody continues to focus on government debt and saying government debt, you know, you're looking at Greece, you're looking at Italy, you know, and so now the United States is getting up there. And you're saying, wait a minute, that's an impact to some degree, but it's really rapid escalation of private debt that you have to be worried about.
That's right. And in fact, you know, for all these major crises, and we looked at every single one in every country going back as far as there's data, which for most cases is back to like World War II, in every single one of these cases you have a rapid rise in private debt, but government debt is actually well behaved or improving in the pre-crisis period because the runaway private debt, everybody thinks it's an economic miracle, things are good, happy days are here again. And tax revenue goes up. So, you know, in Spain, prior to the 08 crisis, government debt to GDP had actually improved 13% in 5 years. Now, nope. After the crisis, when the government's trying to clean up the mess, that's when you have the rapid escalation in government debt. But it's kind of after the fact.
So you said we looked at every single, you know, situation and so forth. Am I correct that when you say that, you're saying developed country situation, not, you know, like Argentina or Brazil or Mozambique or anything like that?
That's right. That's right. Well, there, you know, the top 20 countries
Brazil
in the world
there,
constitute 80% of world GDP.
But so that's what you were looking at.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So your point's well taken. You know, Trinidad and Tobago can have a crisis. You know, for a lot of reasons relating to neighboring countries. We're talking about the big countries that drive the world.
Yeah, because Argentina's situation and Brazil's situation was, and well, you know, many of those kind of countries, it was, you know, foolish economic policy on the government's part, or the Weimar Republic of Germany and so forth.
That's right.
But those are unusual scenarios, and they're easy to actually see. What you're talking about is how does a developed nation like the United States end in a 2008 scenario, and nobody seems to understand it?
Well, it's a great question, but, you know, it's a euphoria. You know, loans start growing, and when loans are growing, it feels good.
You know, right.
Houses are being built. Buildings are being built. Employment improves, incomes improve, and the more lending you do until the crisis comes, the more lending you do, the better it feels.
Yeah.
And so again and again, you see major countries kind of getting seduced into this.
So, Richard, I've got to take my first pause, as Noah likes to call it, a pause. But before we do, I just want to say that when we come back, you know, what we like to do when we do a book like this is we're talking about first, let's lay out the history and what did you learn from the history and so forth. But as we get later on in the show, we then want to look at, well, what's happening right now, looking into the future, what should we be worried about and so forth from what your research is saying, and what countries are we seeing of those top 20 that are doing these types of things that we should be worried about, okay? So that's where we're headed. But right now, we have to take this pause, and we'll be right back. Money, riches, and wealth. Take it away, Maggie. Nick. Nick Rehak, take it away.
Now back to more of Money, Riches, and Wealth on Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
All right, Noah, starting off the year on a good foot there. Way to go, Noah. All right, Richard Vague and his book, The Next Economic Disaster, Why It's Coming and How to Avoid It. Richard, one of the key questions I have about the 2008 is how do the regulators miss this scenario and how dangerous it was and is?
Well, you know, it's one of the most important questions, and I've met a lot of regulators over a lot of years, and I think the issue is that the regulators are looking, you know, kind of lose the forest for the trees.
Right. So, go ahead.
Aggregate loan levels of the industry.
Yeah, and you know, but you know, when Greenspan you know, dropped the interest rates down so low in 2000, 2001, 2002, below the rate of inflation, you know, it just encouraged more of this to happen. And then all of a sudden, everybody was making so much money at such low rates. It was like Candyland.
Yep.
And so everybody was enjoying it. So go ahead, Chris.
Well, I was just going to interject. And so you've been around, we've seen it from a distance. You've seen it close up then, Richard. Over the years, though, whether it was the early, you know, it was the Comptroller of the Currency in the 90s, it seems like they're always reactive. They're only doing it when there's already been a crisis, you know, and for years being very tough on specifically telling the banks about how many loans they can make to people who are investing in real estate. You know, we knew people who own 5-6 properties and say, we know we're not going to give you a loan on anything more than 4. Again, they're always doing things after the fact. Is there a way of breaking that cycle for regulators to, and is it just the backdrop of it, but is there a way of breaking that cycle of being preemptive in their regulation?
Well, yeah, my book actually prescribes a formula. You know, my book says that if you have private loan growth of, let's say, more than 17 or 18% mm-hmm. in ratio to GDP in a five-year period,
right.
you're probably going to have a crisis. So my recommendation to regulators is to establish some threshold below that, and when loan growth exceeds that threshold, to step in and either through rates or capital requirements or jawboning or all of the above, prevent it from overheating.
Yeah, and you've really gone into that in a very thorough manner to say that that figure in all these crises really holds pretty strongly. But how much hope do you have that they'll actually do something along these lines?
You know, it's going to take a lot of work to kind of change the mindset around this issue, because this is an issue that's been ignored or under-recognized. So I don't have any optimism that something's going to happen tomorrow, but there's a growing group of economists that are kind of sounding this alarm, and I think over a longer period, this issue will become recognized.
So, Richard, you know, you're saying that, you know, Japan had this problem. Now, I find that fascinating. So tell us what was going on in Japan in 1980s, you know, late 80s, when they were at the peak of their crises or the peak of their economic boom.
Well, I was early in my business career, and I can remember that, you know, seemed like every business magazine cover talked about how Japan was going to take over the world.
Mm-hmm. They bought Pebble Beach. That's close to taking over the world.
Yeah, between Pebble Beach and Rockefeller Center.
That's right.
Those were scary times when people were thinking when that happened. I remember it.
And what was really going on is their banks were lending on a runaway basis. They were making a lot of bad loans, and it looked good while it lasted, but then the day of reckoning came in 1991.
So the day of reckoning comes in 1991. Why is it 20 years later, 25 years later, and they're still unable to really get moving again?
Well, because their private debt is still high. And, you know, at the peak in 91, their private debt to GDP ratio hit 220%. And we think 150% is kind of a warning threshold. So they were way above that. But today, almost 25 years later, as you say, it's still 170%. So corporations and individuals in Japan are still weighed down by private debt. They're having to service debt, pay interest on debt, and that's money that they would otherwise be spending on cars and, you know, restaurants and vacations and things that power the economy forward.
Now, you make an interesting comment, because you say that government stimulus can do a little bit for a country, but government stimulus really isn't that great. And Japan, I guess, is a great example of that, because in 1990, at the peak of their economic boom, just before they went into the crisis, their debt to GDP was relatively low, and now they're at 220 and rising rapidly debt to GDP ratio.
Yeah, Japan is a mess. You know, their government debt.
That's an economic term, right?
The people are concerned, and rightly so.
So, where do you think Japan's headed?
Well, I think that Japan is on this sideways path of essentially zero growth for the past 23 years, as you pointed out. I think we got more of the same, but if private debt and public debt are still continuing to grow, there's going to be a day of reckoning. There's going to be some restructuring of their government debt at some point. It's unavoidable.
Yeah. What about Italy and Greece and Spain?
Well, you know, you're talking about the peripheral countries of the Eurozone, the so-called pigs countries.
Right.
Portugal, Ireland, Italy, Greece, and Spain.
Well, Ireland's a miracle in my regards.
It's Ireland. Ireland, you know, if we use our 150% threshold for where we get concerned about private debt, Spain is at 210%. Ireland's at 300%.
Are they still at 300, though, after all they've done to improve things?
Absolutely. Wow. Absolutely.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, they're nowhere near being out of the woods.
Huh. What about Italy?
Yeah. Italy's probably, I don't have my notes in front of me, but I'm going to say 140, so they're near the threshold of concern.
And Greece?
Greece is about 140, but their government debt is that high as well. So they have kind of the twin towers situation that Japan has. Now, let's keep Greece in perspective. Greece's population is about 10 million people. They're about 2% of the GDP of the Eurozone. Greece in and of itself can't really create any problems for the Eurozone, except that if the lenders in the Eurozone forgive Greece's debt, that means everybody else is going to stand in line and want their debt forgiven too. And that's why people are so concerned about Greece.
Now, somebody said the other day that Greece's GDP is equivalent to Philadelphia.
Yeah. Greece is tiny.
It's really, I mean, you're being from Philadelphia. I thought, I heard that just yesterday. Somebody said that Greece is the size of Philadelphia. I'm thinking, I'm not going there. Anyway.
And there's a lot less people in, I'll save you here, there's a lot less people in Ireland.
A lot less people in Ireland.
That's right. These are tiny countries at the periphery.
Yeah. So Ireland must, their private debt must still be into that real estate, all that real estate mess they got into.
Yeah. They have not dealt with the core issue. Europe as a whole is not dealing with the core issue. If you read all the reports on Euro situation, it's about rolling over government debt or increasing government debt or all these things about government debt. That's not the issue.
Now, when you say this, you know, everything I hear, but I don't have the statistics, but just circumstantial, I hear that Canada has had a boom in mortgages and so forth. Is it at a point where there should be concern about Canada?
Yeah, Canada's at a very high level. Now, Canada has one redeeming factor, and that is they have very restrictive laws as relates to second mortgages or second liens. The Canada got one other situation right now, which is a problem, and that is they're very dependent on oil. So in addition to their high debt, you know, they were feeling good when oil was at $100+ a barrel. Now that it's $45 a barrel, Canada's got problems.
Yeah, I can imagine. Anyway, we got to take a pause again. And it seems like things just seem to fly, you know?
Yeah.
So, Richard, you're going to have to hold on. And when we come back, then we'll start talking about, well, what are we starting to be worried about in 2015 and on? Where are the countries that we need to be most worried about?
Some bigger ones.
That could cause problems in the future. And how do we react to that? How do we prepare for it and so forth? Anyway, right now we got to go back to Nick Rehack, see what's happening out there in traffic. And we'll be back. Money, riches, and wealth. Thanks.
Now back to more of Money, Riches, and Wealth on Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
And we're back. Money, Riches, and Wealth. And it's Amy.
Little Amy from Pure Prairie League. So
there
he's hearkening back.
I guess he's trying to win points with you and I right now.
Sounds like it's Richard's era also.
Yeah, I guess.
Absolutely.
All right, we're here with Richard Vagan. We're talking about the next economic disaster, why it's coming, and how to avoid it. So let me just ask you the big question. What about the United States?
You know, the United States, relative to the rest of the world, is in a relatively good shape now.
Okay.
We had our crisis in 08, and debt levels have come down a little bit. They're still too high. It's still weighing down economic growth. But when we look at the U.S. situation versus Europe or China or Japan or South America or Africa, we once again are kind of looking the best of all.
So there's no surprise in your opinion and ours of why the dollar is so much stronger.
That's right. That's exactly
so
right.
So what is the numbers for the United States right now?
144, and it got as high as 165.
Huh. And
so it's too high. It is weighing down economic growth. We got, 9 million of the 52 million mortgages in the United States are still underwater. Consumers still have negative equity. That's something that 6 years after the fact has still not been taken care of. And those folks aren't able to participate in the economy as vibrantly as we would want them to. There's pockets of problems like that throughout the U.S. economy. But on the whole, we're okay.
Now, I guess, and I was going to save this for later, but since you say that, with 9 million and so forth, what do you do with those people? And you mentioned an interesting thing at the very end of your book about the year of Jubilee. You're talking about a biblical concept that used to take place thousands of years ago, where the Israelites would lend money to their brothers. And if you did, at the end of every 7 years, you had to forgive it. And then if somebody had put up their land, they got it back at the end of every 49 years. So you're talking about that in your book. Why?
Well, when we examine the fact that we've got too much private debt and we begin to examine how could we get it down, there's really no other way that we've been able to see that works. You can't grow your way out of it, because private debt always grows at the rate of GDP or higher. You can't pay it down, because, frankly, that's what happened in 1930 that caused, the biggest contraction in GDP in U.S. history. You can't inflate your way out of it, or you could, but it'd take you 40 years. So you're left with two choices: to either just live with it, which is what we probably will do, or institute some kind of program to try to give relief to folks that are still in distress. It's a very controversial subject. I can't bring it up without people getting mad at me.
We're not going to get mad at you, Richard.
It's a concept that has deep roots. It wasn't just in Israel that this happened. This happened in Babylon. This happened in Egypt.
Right.
Happened, frankly, as recently as England, a couple of centuries ago.
Yeah, but we have to have a program that it discourages people from just borrowing money knowing that they're going to be forgiven it also. So how do you do that?
Well, there's a couple of ways. First of all, most of these folks didn't act imprudently.
Look, Richard, you're preaching to the choir there. Nothing irritates me more than mortgage brokers, real estate agents, and Wall Street syndicators who took these mortgages and made a boatload of money off of them. And they took people that didn't understand what they were doing and lent money to them. And they thought, hey, this is great, and the real estate's going to go up, and I'm going to make a lot of money to boot. So I understand.
Well, to your point, I think if you ever did something like this, it would be a one-time program only. You'd give people 12 months or 24 months to take advantage of it. You might even give the lender or the government an equity certificate in their home as kind of a trade-off. But you give them relief for the underwater portion of their mortgages. And you'd let the lender spread that over many years. I recommend 30, could be whatever. But it's a one-time program. And going forward, you just enforce more rigorous capital requirements. And that's more or less going to prevent runaway lending from occurring going forward.
So one of the biggest lending problems in our country right now, and you talk about a rapid escalation of lending, it's in student loans, and they can't even go through bankruptcy to get rid of that junk. And that's a crisis in our country right now.
Yeah, I'm very concerned about that. But I want to put it in perspective. There's $25 trillion in private debt in the U.S. Student lending is about $1 trillion of that 25.
Yeah, it's not going to cause an economic disaster, but it is a disaster for those people, unfortunately.
There's no question. And the fact that it's excluded from bankruptcy, the fact that there's so much of it going on, period, is not a comforting thing.
Yeah. Anyway, that's a whole other topic in itself. So, you know, the United States, though, we've got this escalating government debt.
Yeah, I was going to say, we have the public side.
We have the public debt.
It's
rapidly escalating.
Yep.
But, you know, the private debt is coming down, and you don't have an increase in private debt over the last 5 years. You actually have had a decrease in private debt over the last 5 years. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's been pretty flat for the last 2 or 3 years. It's starting to tick up a little bit now, but there's no increase that's a concern.
Okay. So what countries in the world are we really concerned about?
China.
Okay. So
we have an unprecedented level of runaway private debt in China right now. Corporate debt in China has grown $12 trillion in the last 5 years.
That's 12 trillion U.S. dollars?
That's right.
In the last how many years?
5.
What were you going to say, Chris?
Well, but they're pretty big, so the percentage is what you're concerned about also. You take that number and then you throw in the percentage, because that 18% increase is what has been the benchmark that you've talked about.
And their increase over the, you know, they're about half our size. We're about 81% larger than
right.
they are from a GDP standpoint. Probably more, but let's just say at least. They've got more corporate debt than the United States, even though we're twice their size. Their private debt has grown 60% of GDP in the last 5 years.
Right.
If you go into China, and I was there just a couple weeks ago, there are what are called ghost cities, entire cities, many of them, with hundreds of thousands of empty condominium and commercial buildings. It's amazing.
So, but, you know, China doesn't do anything on a small scale, though. Everything is big in China, it seems like.
That's right.
You know, so, the fact that they've increased over $12 trillion, and a lot of those are government-controlled companies to some degree that are borrowing the money. So it's almost, you know, China's hard to figure out in a lot of ways. But you don't think so. You're saying it's going to be the same story for China.
Well, you're exactly right in the respect that the Chinese government owns the lenders, owns the banks, and can go in and create whatever kind of fiction it wants to create to kind of paper this over. But what they cannot do, and what we are seeing around the world right now, is that China, the second largest economy in the world, has created so much overcapacity with so many buildings, way too much iron, way too much steel, way too much cement, way too much copper, aluminum. When you look into the data, it's just astonishing that prices are beginning to drop, and they're beginning to drop dramatically. Iron and steel, for example, increased between 2002 and 2011 by a factor of 12. But they got, at that time, they got to a point where there was just so much extra that prices began to drop, and they've dropped 50% since that time. So China is doing what the economists call exporting deflation to the rest of the world. What we're seeing in oil is partly China. What we're seeing in iron and steel and copper and aluminum is mainly China. Prices are dropping around the world, and that's going to continue, frankly, for some time.
Okay.
And by the way, falling prices isn't a problem except for one little factor, and that is companies borrow against those assets. So whether it's companies in Texas that borrowed based on $100 oil, or whether it's companies in Thailand or Singapore that borrowed based on higher copper or steel prices, you got a lot of debt that's collateralized by those commodities whose price is falling.
All right, Richard, we're going to come back. We're going to talk more about this because I think you're right, that this is the main issue that we have to be discussing and help our listeners to understand what are some of the threats for the future. But right now we have to take our final pause with Scott Larimore in the weather. Take it away, Scott.
Now back to more of Money, Riches, and Wealth on Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
So we're back. Money, Riches, and Wealth. Is that the boss?
That's
there
good.
You go. That's from your childhood. What are you talking about, Noah? He was around when I was in college. Oh, well, that may be true. Anyway, we're here with Richard Vagan. He's the author of The Next Economic Disaster, Why It's Coming and How to Avoid It. And we were talking about China, Richard, and, you know, so China goes on this buying spree over the last 10 years to upgrade their country, and the price of oil skyrockets, the price of copper skyrockets, price of steel skyrockets, all these commodities skyrocket, and now all of a sudden they're collapsing. So your thesis or your opinion is it's solely because China has basically stopped doing all that. Yes?
Yep, that's right.
And so how long are they going to continue?
Certainly slowing down that activity. They certainly haven't stopped, but they slowed it down significantly.
Now, there is talk that China is going to put forth a new stimulus project of another $1 trillion and, you know, do more of this stuff, you know, but they're going to try to be more strategic about it. But still, it's going to be controlled by the government. It's going to be foolishly spent.
Yeah, I think if they do that, and, they, you know, it's not unreasonable to think that they're going to do some level of that, they're just going to be kicking the can down the road, even bigger problem when the day of reckoning comes.
So do you feel that China will cause problems for the rest of the world if they really do, you know, have a serious problem?
Yeah, I think it's inevitable whether they have a serious problem or not. I think it's already begun, and I think that their neighbors in the Asia-Pacific region are already beginning to have troubles, and this is countries like Singapore, Thailand, Australia. Australia is a huge exporter to China. They're starting to have significant problems. South Korea, even Japan is a meaningful trading partner there, and they're gonna have troubles. So all the Asia-Pacific region is going to have trouble. But beyond that, Africa has been a big exporter to China. They're starting to feel it. Major countries in South America, including Brazil, Peru, and Chile, have been major. Peru's basically built around copper, and copper prices have been plunging. And when you get beyond all that, you know, Europe has been selling luxury goods in great quantities. You know, the BMW 500 series is the hottest selling car in the BMW line because of China. Louis Vuitton, you know, all the Swiss watchmakers. There's going to be a lot of folks that feel this in a fairly profound way.
Russia probably sells a fair amount of oil to China.
Russia. And by the way, people forget, you know, people overestimate Russia quite regularly. Russia's economy is $2.5 trillion. That's about the same size as Spain.
Sure.
And it's contracting because of their overdependence on oil. So, you know, I think the concerns about Russia have been greatly exaggerated.
So, what does an investor do, in your opinion, based on these economic research that you've done?
Well, I think that one thing to keep in mind, certainly now and for the next several years, is the good old U.S. of A. is a good place to be right now. That, you know, emerging markets are something that I would look at with a lot of caution. I also don't think that we need to be overly concerned about rising interest rates. Interest rates will rise some, presumably, over the next few years. But there's so much overcapacity in the world that we aren't going to see a resurgence of loan demand. And private loan demand is one of the things that pushes interest rates up most readily. So I think folks should expect a fairly benign interest rate environment for some time to come.
But if what you're saying is true, it also is going to be a very difficult environment for stock markets to make too much of a move other than what they've already done over the last 3 years.
Yeah, the stock markets are amazing because, you know, they're kind of, by process of elimination, they end up being, you know, if everything else is lackluster and interest rates are ultra low, it forces people into places like the stock market. So the stock market's been high, and you know, I don't see that necessarily changing, even though some sectors of the stock market, especially energy, are going to see a lot of pressure and are feeling it right now. So it's, you know, it's one of those periods where it's, you know, it's hard to find a place to go.
Right. Now, one of the interesting things, the difference in, that I see between China and Japan is that Japan has a lot of crazy regulation and so forth. I mean, you can't, there's a lot of things that, that Japanese companies can't do, and they protect a lot of businesses. Mm-hmm. And
protectionism, sure.
You know, there's a lot of protectionism in Japan, and China continues to move more and more away from their overt government regulation and freeing up the economy more and more and more. Do you think that'll make a difference in their ability to be able to walk through this with some pain, but not the full pain that Japan has experienced?
Well, I was just there, and, you know, while what you say is absolutely true. However, now that these companies themselves in China are starting to feel pain, they're once again going back to the government and asking for protection. So I think you may see either a slowing down or a reversal of that, at least over the short period. So, I think that China is going to avoid an outright crisis if crisis means bank failures, which is the definition in other countries. But they're going to have a lot of pain.
Well, Japan didn't have any real bank failures either, but their banks became zombie banks. Will China have the same thing?
Yeah, Japan propped up its banks from 91 when the real estate and stock markets collapsed in 90 and 91. The government really propped the banks up until 96, 97, and then they had a major, they had a Lehman Brothers type moment in 96, if I recall correctly, and that they had to go massively intervene, in their banks. So they, in 96, 97 kind of met that banking crisis definition. But, you know, they're, as we said earlier, they're kind of still propping up those banks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A generation later.
Richard, it's amazing. The time is up. I could talk about this all night, you know? I really appreciate your time.
I'm so grateful for your interest. And you guys are students and know the territory, and it's a pleasure talking with you.
All right. Well,
okay.
Richard Vague, next economic disaster, why it's coming and how to avoid it. This is Drew Tignanelli saying God bless.
Radio 680 WCBM.